Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Let's get this started with New Yorker writer D.T. Maxx and his conversations with Stephen Sondheim.
Another 100 people just got off of the train and came up through the ground while another 100 people just got off of the bus and are looking around at another 100 people who got off of the plane and are looking at us who got off of the train and the plane and the bus maybe yesterday. It's a city of strangers. Some come to work, some to play. A city of strangers. Some come to stare, some to stay. And every day, the ones who stay can find each other in the crowded streets and the guarded parks, by the rusty fountains and the dusty trees with the battered box. And they walk together past the postered walls with the crude remorse.
A new book called Finale, Late Conversations with Stephen Sondheim, arrives just as we've come to the one-year anniversary of the death of the great composer who passed away at the age of 91. But before Stephen Sondheim died, New Yorker staff writer D.T. Maxx had been in conversation with him about a profile for the magazine, speaking over the course of a few years about Sondheim's latest projects, his childhood, memories of playing charades at parties with Meryl Streep, and much more. That capital P profile didn't happen because Sondheim got cold feet and stopped collaborating. But an excerpt of those conversations, those interviews, were published in the magazine in February 2022, and now several years of those encounters make up D.T. Maxx's book Finale, Late Conversations with Stephen Sondheim. Joining me right now is D.T. Maxx. Hi, D.T.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also want to point out, D.T. will be at the Strand for a book event in conversation with friend of the show, Patrick Radden Keefe. That is this Thursday, December 1st at 7 p.m. So you begin talking in the book about how a young D.T. Maxx was first introduced to Stephen Sondheim while growing up on the Upper West Side. What was that first exposure to Sondheim's work?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, Allison, I was not always D.T. When I was a child, I was Daniel. And still often are. But so... You know, I grew up on the Upper West Side, and it's the 70s. It's a pretty disorderly time in New York. I'm just a, you know, little kid on the Upper West Side. And I listen a lot, as I tell this story in Finale, I listen a lot to musicals like A Chorus Line. I listen to Fiddler on the Roof. And then one day, my mother brings home from a benefit a copy of Side by Side by Sondheim, which actually includes the song that you were playing. And it just immediately, you know, it just suddenly seems like what music and musicals should be to me. So, you know, I play it. I play it. My father plays it. My mother plays it. Years go by. And then, you know, we're talking about a long time later. I'm a writer at The New Yorker, and Sondheim's name pops up on a list of potential interviewees because he's working on, it sounds amazing, he's working on a new musical. You know, we know he's in his late 80s when he does this. He's working on a new musical, and it's about two Buñuel films. And so one of the nice things about being a New Yorker writer is that you sometimes do get at least a shot at meeting the people you've always dreamed of talking to. And so I took my opportunity.
When you think about young Daniel's experience with Sondheim, how did that experience affect D.T. the writer?
You know, I think there's something about Sondheim that's completely literary. I think it's part of what made him a hard sell in the musical world, but somebody, people like me, have always loved. It's the subtlety that he's able to get into his lyrics. It's the cleverness that I adore in the lyrics and that in some of my shorter pieces, and I'm not comparing myself to Sondheim, but, you know, one can aspire. I would often think about the beauty and the neatness of his rhymes. You know, there's a moment, I was not that long ago, I went to see Into the Woods, and there's a line in there which I still think must have given Sondheim just the most exquisite pleasure every time he heard it, which is this line about the cow, and the rhyme is, "Well, her withers wither with her." And so that kind of thing, you know, combined with the ambivalence, you know, there's just something about Sondheim that captured for me who I was and captured me the city I lived in. The rhymes about battered barks, crude remarks, I forget, it's like padded park, something like that, in the City of Strangers song just still totally reminds me of exactly what it was like to grow up in New York.
When you thought about putting together this book, why did you decide on this format, the transcript format? It is edited for clarity and to be concise, as we often see in magazines, plus a little bit of detail of what's happening at the time of the interview. Why this choice as opposed to going a more narrative route?
Well, I mean, there are a bunch of reasons. I felt like Finale is very deliberately called conversations and not interviews. And I worried that the more I put my finger on it, the more I shaped it, the less we'd actually get who Sondheim was. You know, people reveal themselves, you know this as an interviewer, people reveal themselves in their speech. And although speech totally unedited is often unintelligible, it's not always unintelligible. And Sondheim actually was one of those people who spoke beautifully. So when we say it was edited for consistency, really not very much, not like a typical interview in a typical magazine. I mean, there were almost no ums to take out. He knew what he wanted to say. And even when he didn't know what he wanted to say, he somehow knew how to fill that space. You know, on one level, he was a performer, although he always insisted he was a backstage kind of guy. But on another level, you know, he did reveal himself. I mean, the pleasure for me, first of all, the pleasure of the book was being with him. Mm-hmm. I mean, I always say this to people. They're like, what was it like? And I'm like, well, imagine that you're in Vienna and somebody says, you know, why don't you go over to Mozart's house and just, you know, have a conversation, just see what's on Mozart's mind.
Just hang out.
You
know,
you go. And so, you know, I live in a terrific suburb of New York. And I'm quite happy here, but that kind of conversation is not, you know, available at the Paneras. So the opportunity to go and see Sondheim was just absolutely, you know, just an absolute stunning opportunity. And then he was fun. I mean, the book is meant to show you a lot of different things about Sondheim. But one of them that I really, really do hope Finale conveys is that he was fun. I mean, people liked to be with him. He wasn't the meanest guy. He also wasn't the most, you know, I don't want to say sweetest guy, because he could be enormously sweet. But, you know, he had a little bit of an edge to him. And I think I would have done him a disservice if I had edited that out. But mm-hmm. He was really smart. Really, really smart, Allison.
One follow-up. What suburb?
Oh, Montclair.
I knew it.
I know. I knew you'd know it. I looked you up. I know Allison's birth town, and it's very close.
Very close.
Very close.
It's interesting you said that he was willing to talk openly. I would use the word possibly dish. He's very willing to dish. He called Scott Rudin volatile. We all know that. Saying the most overrated film is Vertigo. Did you get a sense what was behind that kind of candor with you, a journalist? Or was that part of his being a wee bit performative, to your point of him being a performer?
Well, I mean, the thing I enjoyed about the experience was it was both. I mean, you know, Sondheim was a veteran. You know, there's different people one can interview. There are people who have never been interviewed. There are people who have been interviewed too often. You know, he sat in a nice position where I mentioned this after. So my first interview with him is an audition, so there's a lot of confusion goes on with Sondheim, and I don't think I'm the only one who thinks one thing is going on, and in fact, another is. I think I'm interviewing him. He often, during this book, thinks he's auditioning me for an interview, for a profile, mm-hmm. more accurately, because we are doing an interview. He's auditioning me for a profile. I think I'm profiling him already. You know, so he's having fun. I mean, the man loved puzzles, right? And I was a puzzle to him. He was a puzzle to me. The format's a puzzle. And most of all, life is a puzzle. And I thought, believed, and I hope to some extent, did get, you know, Sondheim at the very end. He wasn't a fool. He knew he wasn't going to go on forever. You know, I don't think he wanted to say everything, and I wouldn't have advised him to if he had asked my advice. But I do think that he was able to show a bit of himself. Most of all, I think the need. You know, the need is a very hard thing for anyone to show. And for Sondheim, you know, he didn't come from a culture where you showed the need. You know, there's, if you look at his background, about which he was incredibly verbal. I mean, one of the great surprises for me about my encounters with Sondheim is his, you know, his hatred for his mother, who, mm-hmm. a woman named Foxy Sondheim, wonderfully enough. But his hatred for his mother was completely unabated, what, maybe 20 years after her death? I mean, I thought we were talking about somebody who might come into the room, you know, and tell him it was time to finish his interview or something. I mean, it was really intense. So childhood lived quite close for him, I think, in a way that was interesting. And, you know, I make it a practice, Allison, not to do any free psychoanalysis of my subjects. But how can you entirely mm-hmm. not think about all of these things, you know, when you listen to Sondheim's musicals? So, I mean, that was very, it was very interesting and illuminating and surprising to me. We spent a lot of time on his childhood when he was when he's 85, 86, 87.
As I mentioned, there are minor directions and you kind of describe the scene. Did you notice any pattern where he wanted to dodge or redirect the conversation?
Well, a couple of answers to that. One, he always said, come and see me, but not for too long. And one of my joking titles for Finale for a while was Profile Me a Little. That was my takeoff from a Sondheim song, you know, Profile Me a Little, but not too deep. So there was a lot of evasion, which is another way of saying he was a human being, you know, encountering another human being about whom he knew only so much. He didn't want to talk, you know, what he didn't want to talk about. Okay, I'll give you two areas. I think I didn't go there and I don't think he would have welcomed it. I don't think he wanted to particularly talk about being gay. I don't think it was, and not because he was in any way ashamed, but because he just, you know, just wasn't going to be what we were going to be talking about. He was from a generation, and it just wasn't what he was going to talk about. Not with me, anyway. He was going to acknowledge it. He was going to have fun with it, but he was not going to talk about it. And then the other thing is, I don't think he was thrilled with anything about being Jewish. Again, not that he was ashamed or hiding it or anything like that. His only comment, and it wasn't to me about being Jewish, was I think he once said when someone asked him, did you ever encounter any obstacles from being Jewish? And he said something like, how many Goyish composers can you name in showbiz? But that's an evasion, right? We both mm-hmm. know that's an evasion. There's lots of ways you can encounter opposition to who you are. And I feel he must have. I mean, again, I don't have my license and it was mostly an experience of just hearing him talk, but he must have. I mean, I think he did and I think he must have.
My guest is D.T. Max. The name of the book is Finale, Late Conversations with Stephen Sondheim. And the way that reading it, it felt a little bit, maybe in the audition stage also, but more like an early courtship. Like you don't want to call too soon. When are they going to call? I don't want them to wait too long. Do they like me too much? Do I like them too much? Was this particular to Sondheim, or do you find, just as a journalist in the big picture, do you find that that dance is something you have to do? Maybe not quite as courtship-like.
Yeah, you know, the thing about a New Yorker profile, right, is it's a lot of visits. So, for instance, if Sondheim and I had gone the distance, I probably would have seen him 10 times by the time it was over. I mean, it's not normal. It's not a normal interview. I work for a lot of other places. Mm-hmm. That's not normal. So you're going to have to call upon, I think, a different basket of skills. You know, it's a marathon, right? And like any marathon. Now Sondheim came from a very romantic generation, I think. And I think he liked observing the niceties observing them. I mean, the first thing I would walk in, this is, you know, in each scene that I'm at his house, and I'm at his house, I think, three of the five scenes. Immediately when I sit down, a woman comes out from swinging, you know, kitchen doors and offers me a glass of wine. And we sit in a room, you know, in his townhouse in Turtle Bay that, you know, is as much like a theater set for an august composer lyricist as you can possibly imagine. One of the things that I worked on hard in talking to him and being with him was, you know, to see him in moments that he wasn't used to being seen in. At one point in the book, I describe him as well nested. You know, he really liked his house. His house was his stage set. So I did try, you know, I often feel like if you can go with somebody you're writing about to the supermarket, you learn more about them than if you spend an hour, you know, discussing their theories of Hegel. I mean, we give ourselves out in our actions. We all do. I do. Now, he didn't really go to the supermarket by himself. I mean, that's what makes Finale kind of interesting, is in a way, all he does by himself at this point in his, all Sondheim does by himself at this point in his life is he tries to compose. He's clever and affectionate with his friends. And he's driven places, two things where he takes in being Sondheim. And yet, one of the things I felt was incredibly interesting, Allison, was unlike all the famous people I've interviewed, or almost all, he completely lacked a certain kind of hauteur. He completely lacked a certain kind of self-regard. Hmm. By which I don't mean he didn't know what he, who he was or what he was, but his presence wasn't, he didn't repulse you implicitly by his presence. He welcomed you. And in fact, he was the kind of guy who, if you met him out of context, and I have friends who did, they just meet him at a party of any sort, and they would introduce themselves in this kind of, you know, oldish guy with, you know, kind of an unkempt beard and a smallish fellow would, you know, extend his hand and go, I'm Steve Sondheim. You know, I mean, that's not, you know, I'm Wolfgang Mozart. That's not a normal moment in New York. And I think it's truly who he was at the same time as, you know, he was enjoying, but it was who he had to be. I mean, it was just, that's who he'd been for a long time too, I think, by then. He didn't want to get isolated. You know, he wanted to meet people. He always did want to meet people, at least in some contexts.
There's an extended scene where you are observing Stephen Sondheim and Meryl Streep at the Pen American Awards ceremony. And they just kind of go, back and forth, and they're chit-chatting and they're joking with each other, and they've got inside jokes and experiences. As you said, people give away something just in their casual conversation. What was something that you got from that interaction, watching him and Meryl Streep?
Well, one thing pals. I got was, well, I got a couple of things. One, they really liked each other. I mean, they just liked each other in a way that, you know, I mean, I don't spend a ton of time around Hollywood people, but there's a certain kind of instant friendship that Hollywood people can affect, especially in front of journalists, that, you know, doesn't last outside the room. They did really like each other because, you know, they were both smart. They were both, they're both a little offbeat, both smart. You know, I mean, frankly, they also both had been identified as gifted at an age where, you know, most of us are still deciding whether to go to graduate school. The other thing that I learned, which was kind of fun and strange, was that he was very competitive around me. He was competitive for Meryl Streep's attention. He put me down in little ways. Now, I come from a family of joshers and kidders, so for me it was as entirely familiar, and almost in a way like a warm bath. But it did surprise me, you know, that he would feel the need to tease me. But he did, and Meryl enjoyed it, and she responded by, you know, we had a funny little three-way. And then they started talking about charades, as you noted in the introduction, which, I mean, their passion for that game, I've never been a fan. It's always struck me as just one of those really awkward moments, and that may be the point. But their passion for charades was really, I mean, then they were in sync. It was, you know, it was a routine that was utterly natural. It was a performance without performing.
Yeah, they seem like their relationship is a hug versus an air kiss.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's right. A hug and then probably a clever present, you know, Christmas time.
My guest is D.T. Max. The name of the book is Finale, Late Conversations with Stephen Sondheim. The project that he's working on at the time is inspired by films by the Spanish filmmaker Buñuel. He's struggling, or the project is struggling. What was he like, someone who had such great command of his work and such great success? What did you observe about him as he struggled, and what the struggle, how it affected maybe even the way he interacted with you?
He's working on this project. The book is being written by David Ives, the playwright, and it's based on the discreet charm of the bourgeoisie and the exterminating angels. So these are two Buñuel movies, which, as Sondheim summarized accurately, one is about people who go everywhere and can never get anything to eat. And the other one is about people who wind up somewhere to eat but can't get out. And, you know, that's not the easy. I mean, so Sondheim, just barriers to profile 101, right? The basic thing you do in a profile, and I might have done it with Sondheim, is you draw a connection between the work and the person, right? But Sondheim had book writers, and a book writer in a musical actually plays a much bigger role than I understood before I started the reporting on this story. So what do Sondheim's musicals have in common is a really complicated question, because then you ask yourself, was this a good project? Was the Buñuel a good project for him to take on? Because, you know, as he pointed out, it has no characters. They had to make up the characters. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, because if you've ever seen the movies, you know, people do kind of have solos in the movie. So it's good for singing. So what gave him so much trouble? I mean, well, maybe being, you know, 87, although he certainly seemed like he could do anything at 87. He once said that composers do their best work by 55. I don't know if he regretted saying that. I don't know if he still felt that. He didn't repeat it to me. But I feel that, you know, he would come to me, you know, we would talk and he would say that he hadn't had a good day working, that he was working, but he didn't have a good day working. And his main preoccupation, which he said to me explicitly. So the book is structured through five conversations. And I think conversation four, I go up to his country house in Connecticut. And it, because it's not the city and it's not a stage set anymore, it's the most relaxed conversation we have. It's the only conversation where you feel him utterly off stage. You know, he's just up there with the dogs. It's a pleasant day out, but he's in, like all creative people, just when you want to be out, you got to be in to work because you always may work. He hadn't had a great day morning, although I did see the music and I thought it looked pretty good. I mean, I did a little sight reading as I walked into his study. But he said, and I think this really, really, really bothered him later years, that he felt out of date. So by that, he meant that his music, which essentially comes out of the 30s and 40s, harmonically rich, you know, involving character and the manipulation of character, the changing of character through time, just had nothing to do with what listeners wanted anymore. And I don't know exactly why he believed that, because I, like everybody, said, that's ridiculous. You know, it's the only time I called him a genius. You know, I always felt I was with a genius, but I felt calling him a genius opened up problems. And so I didn't do it. You know, and so the one time I said, but you're a genius. And he kind of acknowledged that he was a genius. And you can't see this on radio, but he made a kind of a little bit of a bow, a little bit of a mock, playful bow to me. And then he said, really? He said, the real geniuses. So he was distinguishing between genius and real genius. So he says, the real geniuses like Stravinsky and Gershwin and Picasso, and those are the three people he named, are able to take in everything that's new in the culture and make it into their art. And he was saying, I can't do this. I haven't been able to do this. He said, he made a comparison. He said that his father had loved Victor Herbert's operettas and some other guy named Behar, I think, who some listeners will know if I have the name right. And he had thought they were old fashioned. And then he used a four letter word that we can't use if we're especially not on Giving Tuesday, and everybody should give, and I will give. And he said, and now I'm old fashioned again, that word. And so, and I thought, no, you're not. But then later, you know, I saw, for instance, he had a copy of Lin-Manuel Miranda's libretto, I guess you'd call it, from Hamilton on his shelf. We didn't directly talk about the book, but I did sort of understand that work, that Hamilton had actually, you know, shown him something about what he could be doing if he could be doing exactly what he could be doing. And so, I mean, I can't, again, say exactly how it lived in his mind, but I was sensitive to the fact that that existed as something new to him. You know, eventually when you feel out of date, somebody comes along and shows you you're out of date.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what's that moment in Dirty Dancing? Remember when they're playing a conventional ballroom tune and then the rock starts and suddenly all the kids go crazy, you know, right. Bop, 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 this kind of thing. I forget the song. Anyway, someone eventually shows you, like, you know, you're out of date. And I think for him, he took, I think, the wrong message from that. Mm-hmm. I mean, even Lin-Manuel Miranda felt he took the wrong message from that and has been sort of extravagant in his compliments for Sondheim and says, and I think I quoted in Finale, he says, nobody who's not kidding himself, you know, can write a musical today and not realize he's in the shadow of Sondheim. I'm paraphrasing, but I think that was really hard for Miles. And I just think it lived with him all the time and maybe sat on his shoulder at the piano. Cause I don't think technically he couldn't have done what was in front of him to do, you know, but you have to believe in the urgency of your mission. And I'm not sure he so much did at that point.
Did he ever say to you, this is off the record, during these five conversations?
You know, not much. There's a couple of things I took off record because they were, well, I mean, he had asked, and anytime he did ask, I did. There were a couple of comments that were just super snarky and he regretted them. And I kind of felt like actually they would get too much attention. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like not really, you know, he could be catty. I mean, he's catty in the book. And he could be mean, but I didn't find that to be him. You know, one of the things I joke about Finale is I've written the only showbiz memoir that's not, you know, not catty. Like, it's the only showbiz memoir that's not cruel about other people. It's a style in showbiz, you know, that your book is all about how you were right and they were wrong. I mean, and Sondheim wrote a couple of books that sort of capture that idea. You know, I mean, the new Mary Rogers book is a wonderful book. But, I mean, it's all about that kind of one-upsmanship. And I wanted a more collegial book. I felt in late life Sondheim was fundamentally collegial. He wanted his shows produced. He was sort of open to a lot of different kinds of production because he was also, I think, worried. He knew he was a theater composer, and if it wasn't performed, it wasn't going to last. I don't think he quite counted streaming and downloads and so on. I mean, they didn't, for whatever reason, they didn't live for him the way theater lived for him, the whole show. He wanted the whole show. Or I think in the case of Into the Woods, you know, he's perfectly happy with the Happa show that kids do throughout America that ends, you know, at the end of the first act with a very satisfying ending and gets everyone home for bedtime.
The name of the book is Finale, Late Conversations with Stephen Sondheim. It is from DT Max. DT will be at the Strand for a book event with Patrick Radden-Keefe on December 1st at 7 p.m. Thank you for the time today.
Thanks, Allison.